Blog Talk Radio.
Merry Christmas, everybody, and welcome to Yvonne Brooks Show on this Christmas Eve. We're going to be talking about a lot of different things today. We're going to make it kind of a mishmash show, and I'm encouraging you guys to call in. So we've got a phone number, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075, and press 1 once you call in, and call in with any kind of questions, any kind of issues you want to raise. I've got a few things I want to talk about, and then we're going to get to Christmas. I'm going to leave the last half an hour for Christmas. I also encourage you to wait for that last half an hour and call in with your favorite Christmas movie. So I'm going to go over a list of the top 25 Christmas movies ever, but I encourage you guys to call in with your favorites. Let's see how much correlation there is. And then, you know, the list is on my list. I'm not huge on Christmas movies, but you know, call in today. Let's make this a interesting Christmas movie. By the way, we are broadcasting Facebook Live, I think. Let's see. Yeah, we are live. So and I see Penny is still shopping. I don't know how she's watching this. Probably on her iPhone while she's shopping. But those of you who are still shopping, you can get this on mobile devices. You can listen to it anytime, but hopefully most of you have completed your Christmas shopping. I actually have to run to Best Buy right after the show just to finish up. Just one last thing. All right. A few things I want to talk about today. I want to start off talking about kind of a depressing topic, but we'll try to get it out of the way quickly. But I got a lot of requests to talk about this, and I get hounded regularly on this issue. So, we'll just dive in and talk about it. I'm watching myself on Facebook Live, and that's very, and of course, this week we had a terrorist attack in Berlin. An Islamist took his truck or actually hijacked the truck, killed the Polish driver, murdered the Polish driver, and then took the truck and drove it through people, killing 12 people, injuring about 50. Of course, this is the second time we've seen this particular tactic used. It was actually used to more devastating effect, even in France not that long ago. I think it was a Nice where a truck was driven through a crowd and killed many, many people. So just horrible. Of course, this is a crowd that was celebrating Christmas and a Christmas festivities. And of course, this brings up a lot of questions that relate to Muslim migration into Europe, Muslim migration into the United States and so on. But let me just point out a few things. One, this guy, everybody knew he was a terrorist. So the guy who did it, it was identified as the terrorist by Italian authorities, was on a watch list in Germany. If the security forces, if the police, if they just did their job, this is a little bit like what do you call it, 9/11. If they just did their job, this would have never happened. And I think so many of these terrorist attacks, the fact is that in spite of the millions of Muslim immigrants in Europe and in the United States, almost all these attacks are committed by people that are on watch lists. And if we only got aggressive with those, that would solve much of the problem in terms of these terrorist attacks. But there's a broader question here, and that is, what should be done? And I've said this many times, and I guess I have to say it many more times because people are not listening, or people are not taking it seriously, or people still have questions about it. But the only way to deal with this threat is to take it seriously. Is to take it as a real existential threat. And the only way to do that is to actually declare war. and actually go on war footing. Now, that would require the United States and its allies in Western Europe to declare war against the Islamic totalitarians of the world. And you can't just declare war against an ideology. You have to declare war against specific political entities. And you can do that. We can make a list. I can run off a list right now, but somebody would have to take this seriously and actually create a list of those who are engaged in war with, that would include Saudi Arabia, it would include Iran, it would include Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and many of the organizations that are committed to death, to death of anybody who's not a Muslim. Or anybody, at least, who does not succumb to Islam. So it requires, first and foremost, to recognize the enemy, identify him as Islamic totalitarianism, Islamism, radical Islam, jihadism. I know some of you prefer the term jihadism. It's not Islam. If Islam is the enemy, then who should one fight? There's no end to it. It's just confusing. It's just disorienting. To call the enemy Islam is just, it gives you no guidance epistemologically, morally, or politically in terms of who to go and kill. If you're at war, your job is to kill the enemy. It's not true that the enemy is 1.4 billion people that need now to be killed. So one has to define the political enemy. The political enemy is those entities, political entities, organizational entities, military entities, that advocate for, you know, this totalitarian ideology. So the enemy is totalitarian Islam, Islamic totalitarianism. The enemy is jihadism. The enemy is those who has imposed Islam on everybody else. If you want to live a Muslim world in your Muslim village, and you do not constitute a threat to me or to anybody else, then I don't care. You're not the enemy. You're the enemy if you constitute a threat. And I don't believe that all Muslims constitute a threat. I've lived among Muslims, and they don't. But those who take their religion seriously, those who take their try to enforce it consistently, do represent that threat. Those are the Islamists, those are the jihadis, and those are the enemy. So it doesn't help to define the enemy's Islam, not unless you're talking about a philosophical enemy. I'm talking about an existential enemy, an enemy you can actually do something physical with, an enemy you must destroy, versus a philosophical enemy that you debate. So the political enemy, the existential enemy, the enemy that must be destroyed is jihadism. And the way to destroy it is to destroy its political manifestations. It's to destroy political entities. And, you have to start with somebody like ISIS. You have to wipe them out. You have to really destroy their capacity to do anything. And that should be easy. It shouldn't take more than a week if the United States really wanted to go into, parts of eastern Syria and parts of northwestern Iraq and just devastate and destroy Islamic Jihad. That would immediately demoralize many of these people in Europe who think that the Islamic State is the second coming of the caliphate and will establish Islamic rule in the Middle East and the rest of the world. If they are devastated and destroyed, the ability to recruit new people to this ideology will be reduced dramatically. And you're seeing it right now in Nigeria. The Nigeria army is basically wiping out Boko Haram. You remember Boko Haram, it killed hundreds of people, kidnapped young girls, terrorized vast areas of that part of Africa, in Nigeria and other countries adjacent to Nigeria. And finally, the Nigerians took it seriously, and they went out, and they're basically wiping them out. And that is going to reduce recruitment to radical Islam in that part of Africa. There's no question in my mind. People are recruited towards an ideology that they believe can be successful, that they can believe will change their lives. If they believe that the only thing to come from being recruited to this ideology is death, then they won't do it. Now, there's a certain percentage of them that don't care because they believe in 72 virgins. But the fact is, even today, there are very, very, very few Muslims ready to commit suicide in the name of 72 virgins or anything else. That's why, in spite of all the millions of Muslims in Europe, once in a while, there's a terrorist attack. It's too much. It's unjustified. But it's not millions of terrorist attacks. It's not like every Muslim out there in Europe is willing to commit suicide for the cause. So if you demoralize them, if you make it clear that their ideology is a failure, that what they're advocating for will never happen, fewer of them are going to advocate for this. It doesn't mean it's going to be eliminated completely, but just fewer people are going to join. Fewer people join a losing cause than join a winning cause, no matter what the religious motivation is. I don't care. When Christianity became a winning cause under Constantine, when it was embraced by the Roman Empire as the ideology, that's when it grew. That's when it became, that's when everybody joined. That's when it became cool and sexy and popular to become a Christian. And the same thing with Islam. As long as it succeeds, when Islamic State gains lots of land, that's when it gets most of its recruits. When it's losing, it's going to get very few recruits. And if it's crushed without any question, it'll gain even fewer recruits. Now, you can't solve the problem, though, just by destroying ISIS, because ISIS will be replaced by something else. Just like ISIS replaced Al-Qaeda, there's still an ideological vacuum. You have to destroy this entire option. You have to destroy the entire possibility of advocating for political Islam. You have to destroy the entire possibility of being a jihadi and believing that anything positive can happen from doing it. And the only way to do that is to go after the source of this ideology, to go after the places that advocate for it, preach for it, give it moral authority, and also that fund it, support it, train, weaponize it. And those are the regimes of Saudi Arabia and Iran. So if you do that, if you declare war and you go after those regimes, and it could be a short war, and I think the problem with Islamism at least can be pushed out into the distant future. Not that radical Islam will disappear, but that its advocates will go and find a cave somewhere and hide in it, and they will not pose any kind of threat, to us on the West. You know, and they will just disappear, the Islamists. And then maybe the rest of the Islamic world, you know, will actually, be able to. I'm just wondering if the Facebook Live is working. I can't tell. Anybody in the chat on Facebook Live, can you tell me if it's actually working? I can't tell. My Facebook is kind of frozen on me. I think the entire Facebook page. All right. Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. Is Facebook Live still working? It's working. Okay, good. So you're seeing video. You're seeing video and you're hearing sound and everything's cool. Good. All right. So, you know, they go bury and we can live another 100 years without a threat from Islamists, just like they weren't a threat after the Ottomans when the Ottomans were pacified, there was very little threat that came out from the Islamists. So there are lots of options here, lots of options, but you have to destroy them. Now, when you declare war, then, because I get this question all the time, and I got it again on Facebook, it says, why do I oppose ideological screening of Islamists when I'm willing to bomb them, but I'm not willing to ideologically screen them when they enter the United States? Well, I've never said that. When you declare war, it's quite reasonable to say the enemy cannot enter the U.S., but you have to declare war for that. You have to define an enemy very clearly. If the enemy is Islamist, Islamists are not allowed to come into the United States, shouldn't be allowed into Europe. And at that point, yes, an ideological screening is appropriate. Just like during World War II, it was quite reasonable to say Nazis cannot come into the United States. And if you're a Nazi, then you're not welcome. So ideological screening in the case of war, in the case of an emergency, is absolutely appropriate. There's no problem with it. It's important to define the ideology you're fighting in a war, and it's important to know who the enemies are internally and externally, given that ideology. So the idea that I don't advocate for ideological screening in a time of war is ridiculous. Now, you want to, I know, you want to say, well, now let's extrapolate outside of a war, and anybody I don't agree with shouldn't be allowed into the country. Well, that's nuts. To give the government the power to decide which ideology is acceptable and which ideology is not acceptable is nutty, except at a time of war when it's doing its function of protecting individual rights. When America has been attacked, as it was in 9/11 and previously by Islamists, then it is the job of the United States government to figure out who is this existential threat and how to destroy it and what ideology is involved, and to prevent people who hold that ideology from coming into the country. So I'm fine with a ban on Islamic immigration, particularly of Islamist, radical Islamic immigration during a time of war. And indeed, more than that, and this relates to Muslim immigration into Europe, I have never defended the open borders let hundreds of thousands of Muslims all come into Europe all at once because there's a civil war in Syria. I mean, that is absurd. That is not what open immigration, even in a laissez-faire capitalist country, means. Well, first, imagine the violation of property rights if hundreds of thousands of people are just crossing the border and walking over somebody's property, particularly in a laissez-faire country where there would be, everything would be private property. So you have to have a regulated way in which people enter into your country, because everything's private property in your country, and they can't just walk across and step on other people's property. That's called trespassing. And secondly, if somebody's just basically hundreds of thousands of people are coming in, that is unacceptable for a government. A government has a responsibility within the domain of the borders around it to protect individual rights within that domain. It has to have some control over the number of people there. It has to know to some extent who's there and who isn't. And it's completely legitimate, temporarily, during a time of crisis, during a time of civil war and therefore huge migration, to close the border off and figure out what you do at that point and how you decide who to let in and who not to let in a time of an emergency like that. For example, if there was a civil war tomorrow in Mexico and hundreds of thousands or millions of Mexicans came to the U.S. border, I would not advocate open borders, just let them in, what the hell? I mean, that would be absurd. Right. So during a time of crisis, during times of emergencies, if the incoming population is clearly, in a sense, some kind of invasion or one-time aberration or caused by some external event, you have an obligation as the government to protect property rights in the United States by setting up some kind of barriers. Now, you know, how do you figure out who's an Islamist and who isn't? And of course, they're going to lie. And somebody says the Quran calls for lying. Everybody calls for lying. I don't know a single ideology, particularly a totalitarian ideology, that doesn't advocate for lying for the sake of achieving something. So everybody lies who's trying to violate somebody else's rights. I mean, to single out Islam for this is absurd. So how do you tell? This is what you have intelligence services for. This is what you have FBI screenings when people enter the country for. I've always advocated for those kind of screenings. The fact is that most of these terrorists, almost all of these terrorists, with a few exceptions like the San Bernardino people, are well identified and known in advance for what they're going to do. All right. So I know this hasn't ended. I know we're going to keep coming to this and everything. I know that we're going to keep coming back to this issue of immigration because you guys are never satisfied because I don't agree with you. And I know that you don't think that what I've done is given a satisfactory answer. But the fact is, as I said, I'm not for mass migration into Europe, particularly not by Islamists. I am if we declare war for screening, but we have to declare war. We have to have the balls to call it a war. Otherwise, what are we doing? Otherwise, you know, if by what standard are we screening anybody we don't like? Who gets to decide that? Do we really want to give the government the power to make those kind of decisions outside of the decision to go to war? I don't. You know, I'm sure I will be, and my ideology, we want to be the first thing, so we'd be banned if we gave the government that kind of power. All right. A few other questions that came up. One of them was, why is Merkel so motivated to open up Germany to all these Muslims and all these immigrants? I think basically it's an issue of guilt. It's an issue of German guilt around the Holocaust. It's an issue of Christian altruism. So you see, one of the big myths is that Europe is no longer Christian. Now, in a sense, it's no longer Christian in the sense that they don't go to church and they don't maybe even believe in God. But in the sense of the morality of altruism, they're very Christian, particularly Germans, because they feel guilty. So for them, bringing in a million Muslims or whatever is a form of redemption. It's they feel guilty about the Holocaust, but they feel guilty because they're Christians. And they're altruistic. And this is just them sacrificing. And so what? So they sacrifice. Big deal. Europeans are big on sacrifice, right? And I think Germans in particular are big on sacrifice. So this is just a form of Christian sacrifice, Christian guilt. That's what's engaged here. This is why the Germans are doing it. There's no big political agenda. Now, in the past, there's been an agenda around immigration. Germany and the rest of Europe are shrinking populations. They're very elderly populations. They've got a lot of old people, very few people to do the work in order to finance the pensions of the old people. They need immigrants for this. For the last 50 years, Germany has had a steady stream of Turkish and other immigrants in order to work because they don't have enough young Germans to do the work. And to some extent, or to a large extent, they still need that. So they've allowed for more immigration. They've allowed for a lot of immigration. It just got out of control over the last few years because of the civil war and because of other factors that drove these immigrants in. But at the end of the day, this is about altruism. This is about guilt, you know, by the Germans, by the rest of the Europeans, that is at the end of the day what is going on. All right, what else? There was something else. Da, 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 da. All right, I think that's it. Any questions out there? You can call in 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075, and the calls, you should be able to hear them on Facebook Live. So it should be integrated into Facebook Live. It should be fine. And particularly those of you who haven't called in the past, I'm curious to get some calls from first-time callers, 347-324-3075. Don't be shy. I don't bite people's heads off. And you get to be on Facebook Live with me, so that's cool, and on Blog Talk. So, all right, we've got our first caller. Hi, you're on the Euron Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, Euron. This is Eric from New Hampshire.
Hey, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing great. I had a comment and some questions.
Sure,
I just wanted
ahead.
To say that when I heard you in Beijing, I was really impressed by your public speaking.
Thank you. You had to go all the way to Beijing to hear me speak in public. Right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, Peking University and Renmin University. You and the folks at ARI are the only ones talking about these issues.
Yep.
From the objectivist perspective, you know, it's very different. And you know, when I first heard you in person,
That's interesting.
Can you hear me?
Can't hear the caller. Yeah, I can hear you, but on Facebook Live they're not hearing the call. Your call, which is strange. They should be hearing it. All right.
Let me get to the point. I just wanted to say that it felt like a little bit like listening to Ayn Rand. I know Peikoff cringed. He made a comment saying that he cringed when people would compare him to Ayn Rand, but in a certain sense, you know, you two do sound a lot like Ayn Rand in that nobody else is.
Well, I cringed with the reference to Ayn Rand that I would cringe even more. So I'm no Ayn Rand and I'm no Leonard Peikoff, but I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that. That's
yeah. Right. So my question is, I know Peikoff said that you're a very good debater. And you once said that you like hostile calls. You like people who disagree with you and are hostile to you. I'm just wondering why.
Okay, great. So the question is, for those of you in Facebook Live, is why do I like hostile audiences and why do I like hostile calls? And I think the reason is, first, when there's hostile audience, hostile call, it suggests that people are listening to me who don't already agree with me. And that just makes me feel good. The fact that I'm reaching an audience that it doesn't already agree, that I'm expanding the audience, that I'm going beyond that. I also think it's always good to be challenged, and these hostile calls are challenging calls. They're pushing the envelope, challenging you. They're asking something, hopefully, in some cases, that you've never heard before. It also gets the juices running. You know, it gets my adrenaline going, and I think I get a little bit better when the adrenaline is working. So I like it from that front. But really, I love to talk to what I call virgin audiences. Virgin audiences. Virgin audiences are audiences that have never heard this message before. The audiences that don't know anything about what I'm talking about because they've never heard it before. So, and you know, I love audiences like that. And I think it really challenges and pushes me. And it gets the message to new people. All right. Thanks, Eric. Really appreciate the call. And keep listening to the show. And it's good to have you in the U.S. I hear things in China are getting tougher and tougher and, you know, much more difficult than they were even a few months ago. So it's good to have you in the United States. All right. You can call too. And I apologize that you can't hear it on Facebook Live. I'm not sure why. So I am going to have to work on that to figure it out. I'm getting a new soundboard soon, really soon, and hopefully everything will be jiggered together to work much better than it's working now. So last week was fine. Last week you could hear the caller, so I'm not sure what the difference is between this week and last week. I don't know. Some setting. That's the thing. I need a soundboard that I can understand. Right now I'm using kind of a digital soundboard, something by Duet, called Duet, and I have no idea what I'm doing. So I think that's basically the problem, is my complete ignorance and incompetence when it comes to sound engineering. So all right, we'll keep trying. And we'll keep seeing what works and what doesn't work. And we'll see. Okay. All right. Let's see. But you can call in 347-324-3075. Let's see. There was one other topic I wanted to talk about before we get to Christmas. This was actually suggested by somebody on Facebook. Okay. Let's see. This was suggested on Facebook. And you know what? We're going to take a quick break. And I want you to tell me on Facebook Live if you can hear the commercials. And I might tinker a little bit, but I'm going to take a quick commercial break. And then we will come back and wait a second. Where are the commercials? There they are. And talk about, I think, what should Trump do? Like, what should his administration do? What's realistic for them to do? What would be my advice to Donald Trump? And somebody suggests I cut this out of the show and send it to the Trump administration. Yeah, maybe. Sounds good. All right, here go the commercials. Let me know on Facebook Live if you can hear them.
Creating a better future requires that we do all we can right now to teach young people the right ideas. Classrooms today are beset with irrationality and collectivism. Colleges and universities are hotbeds of socialism and multiculturalism. And even worse, they continue to embrace policies that threaten to stifle alternative views. Each day, ARI makes steady progress in changing the direction of our culture. Help us to continue to inform, educate, and inspire a new generation of leaders. Future intellectuals and activists need your help. Your contribution to ARI in any amount matters greatly in our mission to support the next generation of advocates for reason and liberty. You can help now by visiting www.aynrand.org/support. That's www.aynrand.org/support. Thank you.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit aynrand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to aynrand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
Calling all students. Did you know that each year the Ayn Rand Institute offers essay contests on Ayn Rand's novels Anthem, The Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged? If you haven't read one of these inspiring works yet, now is the time. This year, more than 550 prizes and $90,000 in cash are being awarded. Here's what you want to do before you enter. 1. Visit aynrand.org and view essay contest questions, rules, eligibility requirements, and deadlines. 2. Choose a book and start reading. Immerse yourself in one of Rand's thought-provoking novels and explore the characters, themes, and the unique world she creates. 3. Write your essay. Select one of the three topics presented and get to work. Visit aynrand.org today to learn more about this unique opportunity and for your chance to win up to $20,000. Good luck!
For more than 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has fought to promote ideas that I am sure you, too, hold dear. The power of reason, the virtue of selfishness, and the moral superiority of capitalism. What you're hearing in today's broadcast barely scratches the surface when it comes to everything ARI is doing right now to advance Ayn Rand's ideas throughout the culture. Stay informed about ARI's programs, plans, and successes as a contributor to the Ayn Rand Institute. A contribution of just $50 will ensure that you receive Impact Quarterly, ARI's hard copy 16-page newsletter. Impact Quarterly contains information available nowhere else. Don't miss the next issue. Contribute now at www.aynrand.org/support. Once again, that's www.aynrand.org/support. Thank you.
All right, and we're back. And so let's shift now to something more positive. So let's shift to something that, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. Let me just mention this with regard to this whole issue of the Islamic threat and immigration and all of that is I you know, there was this, I put this up on Facebook and there was this photo published in Haaretz newspaper. Now Haaretz, just to give you context, Haaretz is the leading Israeli newspaper. It's the number one, it's the equivalent of the New York Times in Israel. And it's a very prominent, read newspaper. And it published just a couple of days ago a picture of Prime Minister Netanyahu. So the Prime Minister of Israel holding a copy in the Knesset, in Parliament, of, so he's reading while other people are talking, which is not very polite, but what the hell, right? He's holding a copy of John Lewis's Nothing Less Than Victory. Now, this is an astounding, an excellent book, right? This is a book that explains how one could win the war with Islamic totalitarianism, how one could beat the jihadis. And here is a prime minister of the state of Israel holding, you know, holding a copy. Yes, and it is a leftist newspaper, just like the New York Times. But, and it had a little commentary on the book, basically positive, and then connected John to objectivism, and had a little blurb on objectivism linking, I think, to the Ayn Rand Institute. So, wow. I mean, this was terrific marketing, terrific advertising, but also the idea that somebody like Netanyahu is actually reading John Lewis is exciting. Now, I know Netanyahu has read Atlas Shrugged, and he's read a lot of, I think he's read one of my books, or at least he's read an article I wrote about Israel. I don't get too excited about this because he's a politician, so I don't think anything actually good will come of it. But I do find it interesting, and it was a great photo, and it was a great opportunity. And I wish John was alive and with us to enjoy that picture. It was just perfect. And go, if you haven't read the book, you should read the book. It's called Nothing Less Than Victory by John David Lewis, a good friend, an objectivist intellectual, taught at Duke, and unfortunately passed away, I think it was 5 years ago. So fantastic. One of the best books about, you know, deals with history, with lessons to be learned about the crisis that we face today, lessons from the ancient world and from the more modern world, from World War II. All right, we're going to take another call before I get to advice for Donald Trump. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Merry Christmas, Yaron. This is Corey from Minnesota. How are you?
Hey, Corey. How's it going?
Not too bad. It's actually warming up here today. It's up to 30 degrees.
It's 30 degrees. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's about 30. So we about a 40 degree swing from last weekend. So it's pretty
okay.
Nice. I thought I would get your thoughts on Trump's cabinet so far.
Okay, I think I talked about that last show, but I'd be happy to talk about Trump's cabinet, and then maybe I can go from there into discussion about what Trump should do about taxes, regulations, defense, and entitlements, as somebody asked on Facebook. All right, Corey, thanks for the question,
yeah.
I'm going to take you offline just because it's easier that way. All right, and Merry Christmas, Corey, and hopefully you guys have a white Christmas, because I tell you, we in Southern California do not have a white Christmas. It's very disappointing this year. all right. So what are the most recent appointments, or what are the, you know, it's very mixed. I think there's some very good appointments. There's some mediocre appointments, and there's some very bad appointments. In the very bad appointments, I would characterize, attorney general, whose name escapes me this second, but who is who's very much a religious anti-separation of state and church, very anti-immigration, including legal immigration, very anti-drugs. So a big uptick in the war on drugs, I expect, unfortunately, which means more conflict, more conflict with states that have legalized marijuana. But also a huge, huge opponent of abortions. I expect a lot of problems with that. So I'd say that is one of the worst ones. You know, others that I'm just not that impressed with. Well, Bannon goes under one of the worst. A self-defined economic nationalist and a hater of Ayn Rand, somebody who misrepresents, doesn't understand, and obviously dislikes Ayn Rand, and also very religious. If you read Bannon, he's very religious. Then there was the one this week, another one, the good, the bad, and the ugly in Trump's appointment. These are all the bad. Peter Navarro. Oh my God. So first of all, First of all, Trump has created this trade advisory commission, a committee. This is the first time a president has such a thing. This is the whole idea of advise him on industrial policy. So we now have industrial policy in the United States, like Japan, and look how well it's worked for them. And Peter Navarro is a complete idiot. I mean, this guy is a third-rate economist who, you know, he studied economics at Harvard, but he's still a third-rate economist who hates the Chinese more than Liran does on the chat here. He hates the Chinese viciously and hates trade and views trade as a zero-sum war game. And it's just an idiot when it comes to trade. And the idea that this guy is going to have the ear of the president on a regular basis. He's actually here from UC Irvine, and I've bumped into him a few times, and I just disagree with him so thoroughly about these issues. And he's basically made a career over this whole issue of trade and the evil of trade, particularly with China. He's got a documentary about the evil of China. So just a bad guy. So that's like the bad. Then there's like the, we'll see. You know, and I think there you would have to put Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. I have no idea what to think of that. You know, Rex Tillerson, obviously really smart guy, a good CEO of Exxon, a fan of Atlas Shrugged. But does he know anything about foreign policy? Does he have any positions about foreign policy? Is he any more than he is very good at cutting deals with the Arabs who have oil and the Russians who have oil? And this is, of course, where you have to be a little suspicious. Most of his dealings in terms of foreign entities have been with people like the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and the Russians. And is he going to be very, very pro-Arab because of the oil interests? Is he going to be pro-Russia because of oil and because of his energy interests? He won the Friendship Medal from the Russian government or something like that. So it's just, I just don't know. I don't know what his positions are. He has nothing in writing about what his positions are vis-a-vis American foreign policy. I have no idea what kind of Secretary of State. So I guess that would go under the ugly, just because you don't know. Another one would be under the ugly would go Mnuchin, who is the Treasury Secretary. No idea what he stands for. No idea what he's going to do. I think he's just a pure pragmatist. We got Rick Perry at Secretary of Energy, probably a good thing. Rick Perry promised his campaign to do away with the Department of Energy. I'd like to see for once, one of these guys actually follow through with what they say they're going to do. For once, right? So actually shut it down. That would be terrific. But will he do that? I'm skeptical, probably not. HUD, Ben Carson at HUD. Don't know what he's going to do. Again, a department that shouldn't exist. The United States government should not have housing. And as such, there should be no HUD, right? There should be no HUD. What else? So now his military guys, so Flynn and Mathis, so Secretary of Defense is advisor on foreign policy. They're pretty good, except I don't know about Flynn and Russia. I'm a little suspicious there, but they're pretty good. They're pretty good on the Islamic threat. Mathis seems pretty good about what it means to go to war and how to go to war. So and the need to win the war. So I don't know a lot about Mathis. I haven't read up on him. I need to read more and watch his interviews. But he, you know, a lot of people are comparing it to Patton. I'm a huge Patton fan. So to the extent that he even comes close to Patton, that would be good. Although Patton was also a crazy guy. It's less that he was a fighter, that he was this or was that. What does he think? That's what's important. What is the ideology? What is the ideology? So is he any good? I don't care if he's a general or a civilian to run the Defense Department. What I really care about is that he has the right approach to going to war and the right approach to, if you go to war, to win it. All right. So that's a quick thing on the, you know, and I talked about, I think last show, which you should all listen to because it's pretty good. about the whole idea of all these people are Ayn Rand fans and what does that mean? I don't want to repeat myself here. So what is doable for Trump administration? So if Trump was asking me for advice about what to do in the first 100 days or the first 4 years, right? What would I suggest doing and how to go about it in a realistic way? So not in a, you know, deregulate everything. Your taxes should be zero. Bomb the hell out of Saudi Arabia. But in something that's realistic, to present to a given Congress and given the obstacles that they're going to face. And let's try to conceptualize this. Now, the person who asked the question asked about taxes, regulations, defense, entitlements. But I want to look at this a little differently. The first one I would address, and this should be right up Donald Trump's alley. It's not, but it should be right up Donald Trump's alley. Is the first thing I think that should be looked at. Okay, so this is my plan for the new year. Good for Christmas, right? How do we drain the swamp? Right now, I take the swamp as meaning cronyism. I take the swamp as meaning corruption. The involvement in government in every part of our business lives. The involvement of business in government and just this ugliness and the idea that many Americans have that the system is rigged and the system is fixed. So I would actually put a package together of drain the swamp bills, right? And basically these bills would be, or another way to call it is end cronyism in America. And the number of facets to this bill, I think they're all doable. Very difficult to get by Congress. Very, very difficult to get by Congress because Congress is part of the swamp. They benefit from the bribery of business to them, from being paid off by business. They have every incentive to keep the swamp as it is. So, but I would propose as president, and I think in the name of draining the swamp, Donald Trump can get away with this. I mean, people are ready for something radical from him, particularly in this area. So I would break this down into three buckets. Bucket number one would be bailouts and subsidies, right? And I would go to Congress with a bill that says, with a bill with two parts to it. Part number one is Congress will not subsidize any business, period. Period. Right. So in this context, what we would do is delineate all the different subsidies, the windmills, solar energy, gas and oil and gas, everything. Right. Everything. So and subsidies. Now, this would include farm subsidies, which would be harder. So the phasing out of all farm subsidies over the next 3 years. Over the next 4 years within this administration. So start with the obvious subsidies where government is just handing out checks to oil and gas and other things to farm subsidies. A second part of the bill would be no bailouts. It would be a bill that basically says the United States government is prohibited from bailing out any business or industry. This would involve having to change Dodd-Frank and involve other things. So there's no way. Now, the Federal Reserve, you'd have to redo the whole Federal Reserve charter. Maybe that's for a different day because they could probably bail out businesses through the discount window, which they did in 2008 and 2009. But this is the start, right? We're trying to be realistic here. What could we do realistically? So government will bail out no businesses, not auto industry and not banks. Not auto industry and not banks. And you would have to change Dodd-Frank in order to reflect this as part of this bill. All right. So that's the subsidies part of it, right? But this is all one big package called ending cronyism. Part number two is taxes. And in this part, it's simple, and Donald Trump has actually proposed this. 15% corporate tax rate, flat, and no deductions, no exclusions, nothing, right? Take away depreciation, take away all the artificial ways in which, and just look at some kind of net cash flow and have a flat tax. I mean, I would argue, And I think it's doable to argue this, although I think it would be hard for a zero corporate tax rate. But let's take, but you could do a 5%. Now he's proposed 15, but I assume that's with all kind of deductions and exclusions. A 5% tax rate on corporate positive cash flow. Basically, cash in minus cash out. So something like that, right? But my preference would be simplify it, zero corporate tax rate. You only get taxed on money that goes out of the corporation. That is dividends, capital gains, capital distributions, right? Right. So something like that. Now we could get into the details of the technicalities. I would leave that to the technicians, but basically something that did not provide any loopholes, any exclusions, any special deductions, so that, again, there would be no incentive for business to come lobbying. Now, notice, if you just pass those two, you would destroy, what do you call it, K Street. You would destroy lobbying as we know it. There would be no incentive to lobby, or very little incentive to lobby, because you couldn't lobby for loopholes in a tax code, because there wouldn't be any. And you couldn't lobby for subsidies because there wouldn't be any. Now, the third area of lobbying, why you have to get cronyism in a cronyism bill, is, and this is the big one, the elimination of regulations. And this is very, very difficult. And this is the trickiest part. But again, if you frame it all as end cronyism, maybe you can get away with this. And here, I would have a series of bills taking on a series of industries, which completely deregulates those industries. Now, you'll notice that over the last few days, and I expect in the next few weeks, Obama is going to introduce more and more and more new regulations, hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them, at costs of billions and billions of dollars, to make it as difficult as possible for the Trump administration to undo. Now, every president does this, but Obama is doing more of this than ever, right? He's going overboard. Right, the country just rejected his agenda. To hell with that. Anyway, so take the deregulation thing. I would have a bank deregulation plan, 4 years by which we deregulate the banking sector. For example, lower deposit insurance to $10,000 instead of the $250,000 today. So only really small depositors get to benefit from deposit insurance. The way it was supposed to be originally, and you take away much of the mall hazard out of deposit insurance. Slowly eliminate the power of the FDIC, the OCC. By the way, I would shut down the OCC, the Office of Control of the Currency, of the Fed, to regulate loans, to decide on quality of loans. I would eliminate regulations, raise capital requirements, and do away with deposit insurance as much as you can in the banking sector. Do away with too big to fail. We did that when we said no bailouts. You slowly eliminate all the regulations that have to do with banking. Slowly. Over the next 3 years, they're all gone. All gone, right? So that's a big part of it, right? And I think you can do that. You put John Allison in charge of a committee to draft that law. You give them 2 months to do it, and you present it to Congress within the first 100 days. Then you deregulate the energy industry. So all the licenses, all the restrictions, all the constraints, you just start minimizing those. Then you regulate business generally. You get rid in whole of something like Sarbanes-Oxley. So, maybe you can't deregulate everything all at once, but in this bill to end cronyism, you present a substantive, comprehensive overhaul of the regulations in the United States. We're not going to get to zero regulations, but you show how all these are going to be trimmed, and you introduce principles by which Congress cannot add regulations. At least I think they've got a rule where you can only add a regulation if you get rid of two other ones. I'm not for adding anything, but again, if we're going to be realistic, fine. You got to add one, you have to do away with two. Something like that, where you start seeing a dramatic reduction in regulation across the board. For example, I would appoint a committee to look at how do we deregulate securities regulations, the SEC. How do we go from where we are today to a free market in actual securities in trading? So, and you present that to Congress. I don't know if it's within the first 100 days. Maybe this is complicated. Maybe it would had. Maybe would have to be. It would have to take longer than that. But in every area, in every major area, you present a bill to deregulate that area in dramatic, significant fashion, right? So that is the anachronism category, and that would be a big, like, umbrella bill that would have all these bills within it. And I think that's doable. He could call it drain the swamp bill. It would be incredibly powerful. And just that, if you did nothing else, if you literally did nothing else, that would drive the economy through the roof. That would make the economic growth, that would increase economic growth by 2 percentages to GDP at least. You could get to the 5% GDP growth if you just did those things. Now, it's not just because all of those are complex and they're not easy. But imagine if you put somebody like John Allison in charge, rather than Treasury Secretary or whatever, which is a waste, I think, in charge of helping draft a bill that would deregulate banking completely. I mean, that would be amazing, right? So that would be regulations. That would be the drain the swamp. Second, I would introduce a tax reform that would flatten the taxes. Whether you do one flat tax rate or two flat tax rates, but I think here's the key again. The key for me is no deductions, no exclusions. You don't use the tax code to manipulate people's behavior. You don't give them deductions for charity. You don't give them deductions for mortgages. You take all those away. Now you have to phase them out. You have to do some things. Maybe you grandfather existing mortgages. I don't know. You'd have to think that through, and I haven't thought it completely through. But the point is simple, flat, no deductions, no exclusions. You don't incentivize people to do this and not that. You just make it simple and flat. All income equally the same. For example, one of the things that is most important in terms of investment is get rid of the distinction between short-term and long-term capital gains. It's devastating. It's stupid. No economist believes that this serves any purpose. Speculation, short-term speculation serves a very important long-term financial purpose. So get away with this stuff. Get rid of this stuff. Again, flat, simple, right? Stop manipulating people's behavior using the tax code. All right. So that's taxes. Simple. Simple, simple, simple. So that anybody can fill out his own taxes. Right. I think that is much more important than the rates at this point. Much more important than the rate. Now, the rate should be low, particularly on high owners, particularly in the producers, particularly in the creators. But tax rates should be low. But I'm less concerned at the first step with the rate as with getting rid of making it simple, getting rid of the manipulative elements. And again, if you did these things, the economy would take off. Entitlements. All right. This is a tough one. Now, I would resurrect a proposal done by Paul Ryan to provide vouchers for Medicare. I think this is really, really important. Right. Provide vouchers for Medicare. And then what you do is you provide Medicare recipients with a voucher to buy insurance rather than provide them with the healthcare direct from the government. Now, how do you do this? How do you phase it in? Maybe existing people who already retired get Medicare as it was promised. Anybody retiring tomorrow gets a voucher. And what you say is every 10 years, the voucher goes down in value by X percentage, so that you provide an incentive for future generations to start saving and not rely on government for their health care. So voucherize Medicare. In other words, try to privatize it as much as possible. Try to privatize it as much as possible. And lastly, the same thing then, start the process of privatizing Social Security. Again, you can't do it all at once. And maybe a Trump administration can say we're going to phase it out, but at least privatize it. At least let people open private accounts and put the 12.5% instead of to the government into private accounts. Start with 20-year-olds and start moving up. Right? So again, put in place a few mechanisms by which entitlements are being privatized and moving in the right direction, even if you don't do the phasing out because it's not politically feasible. At least give people options. And then, of course, in defense, I would say much more important than building out, you know, Trump has been tweeting lately about building up on nuclear program and stuff like that. Much more important than that is much more important than modernizing the weapons that we have is to have a clear defense policy, to have a clear the people start believing in what the United States says. And I think you start there by defining the enemy. You start there by defining Saudi Arabia and Iran as enemies, doing away with the Iranian treaty, which I don't think they will do, but doing away with the Iranian treaty. It's not a treaty agreement. Telling the Iranians in unequivocal terms that their nuclear program has ended. And if it doesn't end tomorrow, you will destroy it. Telling the Saudis and the Iranians, if they continue supporting Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, ISIS, and other terrorist organizations, that they will be held accountable for every act of terror and every act of violence that those organizations, and then deploying the U.S. military with a full force to do it, so that the Chinese and the Russians see that we are willing to use the full force of the military, and those two countries will be cowed once they see that. So that would be the essence of my defense policy. Focus on the enemy as it exists today. The enemy as it exists today is the Islamic totalitarianism, the jihadis. Focus on Saudi Arabia and Iran. Deploy military troops to destroy ISIS and any other threat that we have in the Middle East. But destroy, not build democracy, not go in, crush them, and come home. And tell the world, this is the new America. Watch out. Right? And you know, and that's defense. And then I'll end with healthcare and education, two very, very key. And again, he actually appointed two relatively good people for healthcare and education. Now, education, you know, one of the best signs that the Trump administration can give to us free marketers that they're serious about moving towards more free market economics is to shut down some government departments. Education, which has 150,000 employees, I would shut down. You know, leave this to the states. We want reform. We want tax credits. I want education saving accounts. That's the best idea about education that exists out there. But it looks like right now that has to happen at the state level. At the state level is where the education is funded. At the state level is where most K-12 education is regulated. Shut down the Department of Education. Now, things that you can do when you shut them down. The federal government should give no more loans to college students. Privatize that. Shift it to the banking industry. Banking industry is quite capable, quite competent to give loans to people who can actually pay them back. So shut the Department of Education down with all its functions. Return K-12 education to being regulated by states. Not that they're advocating state regulation, but let's fight this battle at the state level. Get the federal government out of education. Just shut it down. Get rid of all the No Child Left Behind, Common Core, and the regulation of private colleges and student loans. All of that should go away. All of it should be privatized. That's what I would do in education. And again, then I'd advocate and push the states to offer education saving accounts. Maybe Congress can force them to do that. Healthcare, do away with Obamacare. But basically, allow, you know, in a sense, find ways to get around state regulations of insurance companies, health insurance companies, to do away with restrictions to buy insurance across state lines, get rid of all government regulations on healthcare as you slowly do away with Medicare. It's not possible to do it completely, but at least if you're under 65, there should be no involvement at all. So just completely privatize everything. Again, if you have the simple tax code, then businesses are not getting a tax deduction for employee health care. You shouldn't get a tax deduction for employee health care, or equate it somehow, right? So nobody should get a tax deduction to buying health care, right? Special tax deduction for that. So make it equal. Make it encourage individuals to buy their own health care through health saving accounts. And just privatize the whole sector. And there are lots of plans to do that. In terms of pre-existing conditions, you cannot force insurance companies to cover those. If you force insurance companies to cover those, then you're destroying insurance. And you're just feeding into ultimately what will be a single-payer universal health care provided by the government. If you want to still cover people with pre-existing conditions, create a risk pool, a government-funded risk pool to do that for now. And then try to encourage the free market or find ways to incentivize the free market to create its own solutions to pre-existing conditions. There are a number of ideas about how to do this. It's going to take time for those ideas to evolve. In the meantime, create special risk pools subsidized by the government for pre-existing conditions. And that's how you also solve the problem of why would insurance companies sell insurance to old people? Well, you find ways in which to create these risk pools that cover the pre-existing conditions that old people tend to have. And over time, private companies will come up with solutions for this, and then you do away with these risk pools. Or you find ways to create incentives to do this. Again, these are difficult, but you've got to get rid of state mandates on insurance companies. You've got to get rid of state regulation on insurance companies. One way to do that is to allow competitions across states. An ideal way to do that is to deny the ability of states to regulate health insurance companies. I think this has been done in certain insurance markets. I don't remember which ones right now, but there's a way to do that. A Congress can just take that. Now, whether the Supreme Court would uphold that or whether they would declare that state rights or whatever, who knows? I guess it depends on how conservative the court is. A conservative court is going to say states have a right to do this and the federal government shouldn't intervene. All right. So that would be my proposal to the Trump administration for both taxes, regulations, defense, entitlement, healthcare, education, all wrapped up nicely in a bow. That is my Christmas present for the Trump administration and my Happy New Year gift for them. So, you know, anybody want to send it to them, feel free to I'll post this segment as a separate audio, and you can then forward it to whoever you know within the Trump administration and encourage them. And I'm happy to consult on how to implement any of these strategies. So go for it. All right, the meaning of Christmas. I love Christmas. Because what does Christmas actually mean? Christmas is about a celebration of life, of production. It's about lights and trees and gifts and good nature and benevolence towards other human beings. Oh my God, some of you might say. But objectivists are not supposed to be benevolent because we're selfish. That is one of the great confusions and lies about objectivism, not so much a confusion. No, we are the most benevolent. We are the most loving of mankind. Generally, objectivism is the philosophy of love. It's about loving yourself. It's about loving your life. And by extension, loving the people who make your life so successful and so wonderful. It's about thriving and loving and embracing the good that's out there. So, and what is more good than mankind? Mankind that's built skyscrapers and iPhones and this camera that is feeding this to Facebook Live and Blog Talk Radio and all the wonderful things we have. Human beings made that. Human beings made that. And you got to love human beings for their ability to make it, to make my life so much better. So Christmas is a celebration of all that. It's a celebration of the fact that human beings can produce, can create, can make. Now, they are bad human beings. We talked about some of them in the earlier in the show. Yeah, those need to be destroyed. But Christmas, today, tonight, tomorrow, about a celebration of the good human beings. The people you love, your friends, your family, at least a part of the family that you like. And not just your friends and family, but any human being out there who exercises his potential to produce and create and build. This is a great holiday to celebrate Silicon Valley and everything that I know. Some of you hate Silicon Valley because they're leftists. But I go to the more fundamental. They're creators. They're builders. So this is a celebration of all of that. Now, the Christians have taken this holiday, which was a Roman holiday, a pagan holiday, a holiday celebrated around this time of the year in every pagan culture, almost every pagan culture out there. It's a holiday that the Jews celebrate, Hanukkah, which is a celebration of, you know, of rebellion, of independence, of freedom. I put freedom in quotes because it's not real freedom, not individual freedom. It's freedom of the Jews from the Greeks. It's a collectivistic type of freedom, but nevertheless, Hanukkah is celebrating a rebellion of the Jews against the Greeks for religious freedom reasons. The Greeks were trying to impose, this is the post-Alexander the Great, they're not even Greeks, they're really Macedonians, trying to impose their religion and their culture onto the Jews. Now, I happen to think the Greeks had a better culture than the Jews, so sometimes on Hanukkah, I kind of regret that the Jews won that one. Maybe it would have been better for the Jews and for everybody else if the Greeks had won. But nevertheless, Hanukkah is a celebration of the victory of those who were trying to defend their religion against religious oppression against the Greeks of that period, not the Greeks of 300 years earlier, the Greeks of that period who were authoritarian and who were nowhere near, this is nowhere near the height of Greek philosophy and Greek art, which is a period that I would have embraced over Judaism any day. So Hanukkah is a celebration of that. It has a lot of mystical elements, you know, the menorahs, because there was a miracle that helped that kept the menorah alight for 7 days. But, you know, it's kind of a minor miracle. Who cares? And the Maccabees who won were not good guys. They were a bit of religious fanatics, and they kind of imposed their religious fanaticism on the Jewish people after they won the victory. Fine, okay. But, you know, but at the end of the day, pagan, this holiday is a holiday. The Christians adopted. They initiated a holiday at the end of December. I don't think this is when Jesus was born. To the extent that Jesus, Jesus was a real man. He was born probably sometime in the spring, at least that's what historians suggest. But the Christians needed a holiday to compete with the pagans. So what did they do? They took the same time frame, the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, and they picked a holiday around the same time. And then on top of that, they stole all the good things that the pagans, you know, had adopted. So, for example, in Rome, this holiday was associated with gift giving. Scandinavia, and I think in Rome, it was associated with a certain worship of trees, particularly in the cold environment of Scandinavia, where trees were a symbol of life. The evergreen tree is a symbol of life. They brought the tree into the home. And by the way, I just remember this. You guys should live tweet this show, because that's how we're going to get, you know, hashtag Yaron Brooks Show with the link to the show. That's how we increase the number of people who listen to the show, is if all of you live tweet the show, that'll actually encourage people to listen live and then to download, but it'll actually get people engaged. So I forgot to say this earlier, and I should have said it at the beginning of the show, but please live tweet the show. Anyway, All of the customs that today we associate with Christmas were created either by pagans and adopted by Christians, or they were created by greedy capitalists trying to create money. So, for example, Santa Claus, as we know today, is a combination of different characters from different European mythologies. But the Santa Claus we know today is a creation of Coca-Cola from the 1930s. And a creation of retailers who have you know, children sit on Santa's lap and ask for presents and all that kind of stuff. That's all a creation. That's all a creation of Santa Claus. You know, a lot of the lights and the celebration and the benevolence of this, right, is a consequence of 19th century retail marketing. Macy's is, to a large extent, responsible for much of modern day Christmas and the way it's celebrating. And I love modern day Christmas. I love jolly Santa Claus. I love the idea of giving gifts. I love even the idea of Santa Claus judging you and deciding who's good and who's bad. That's very non-Christian, right? Why should a bad kid not get presents? That's not right. Even if he says he's sorry, how about he goes to confessional? Does he still get presents then? Santa Claus judges. If you're a bad kid, you get what? Coal. You get coal. How cool is that? Right? How cool is that? So it's just a, you know, I love Christmas trees. I love the lights. I love the idea of decorating them with the gifts underneath the tree. And again, the tree was Scandinavia celebrating their ability to survive in the face of this harsh winter. And here was a tree that also survived in this harsh winter. So the tree symbolizes our ability as human beings to survive in spite of that. So it's just a wonderful holiday. So those of you upset because it celebrates Jesus' birth, get over it. Get over it. Let those guys over there celebrate Jesus' birth. None of us are really celebrating that. And you know what? They're not even celebrating that because nothing they do actually reflects Jesus' birth. Now, you know, some of the music, some of them go to church, but even church, they go. Why? Because it's nice music, because it's pretty, because they get to celebrate with other people, because they get to hang out with people. You know, it's just a cool holiday. I mean, we always celebrate it here. You know, we open presents in the morning and we have a nice dinner in the evening and we have friends over and we have family over and it's great. It's great. So, favorite Christmas song. Somebody posted this on the chat. My favorite Christmas song is Santa Baby, particularly when sung, and I forget who sings it, you know, in a really, really sexy voice. Santa Baby is the perfect Christmas song. It's just so much fun, right? So, objectivists, if you love yourself, if you love your life, if you love the life that you can have, if you love the life that is there as a potential for you, if you love the world in which you live, and if you love people because of their potential to create, to build, to make, to discover, you got to love Christmas. And you have to remind people all over that we are the benevolent ones. We are the ones who celebrate life. We love this. We love Christmas. We love everything about Christmas. And we love human beings. Human beings. Who is more benevolent than a good objectivist? Now, there are a lot of objectivists out there, I know who you are, who are not benevolent, who are nasty, dogmatic idiots. Stop it. You got to stop it, right? It might have been Marilyn Monroe who sang Santa Baby. She would be perfect for Santa Baby. If it wasn't her, she should have sung it. But that's I think it's Eartha Kitt also sings it. So there are probably a number of interpretations. But I can just envision Marilyn Monroe singing it. It's the perfect kind of combination of sexiness with song. So we got to get over this image that we have as grouches. So stop being a grouch. Stop being fearful. And this is my Christmas message to you all. And then we'll talk about Christmas movies quickly. Stop being fearful of Muslims, of Mexican immigrants, of the economy being destroyed tomorrow. There's too much to enjoy in life. There's too much good in life to live in fear. Stop living in fear. Embrace life. Think about solutions. Think about positives. Look for the positives. Maybe they're not falling on top of your head, but go find them. It's your life. Live it. All right. Christmas movies. I had a list here. Where's the list? Ah, where's the list? The list disappear. Oh, 25 best Christmas movies. All right. So I'm going to list. This is a list. Rotten Tomatoes. RottenTomatoes.com. And you can post your favorites on the chat. Let me see if I can keep track of Facebook Live. You can also post your favorite Christmas movies, and I'll respond on the chat and on there. I'm going to go through these, and we'll cover, I think, many of the ones. Oh my God, you're posting stuff I've never heard of. You're supposed to post movies I know. You can't post movies I've never heard of. How can I comment on them? Right, I'm not seeing anything on Facebook. Nobody's posting anything on Facebook. I don't know. Maybe my feed is dying. All right, number one, best Christmas movie, according to Rotten Tomato, is one of the most evil movies ever made. It's called "It's a Wonderful Life." Ooh, a lot of people are leaving because they don't want to talk about movies. I hate "It's a Wonderful Life." It's a Wonderful Life is all about altruism. It's all about sacrifice. It's all about not following your dreams. It's all about it takes a village and community. Ugh, I hate that movie. It's a socialist movie created by a Marxist, Frank Capra. It's brilliantly made, brilliantly acted, very Christmassy. Shows on Christmas all the time, but thumbs down on "It's a Wonderful Life." It's an anti-Christmas movie, ultimately, because it's got the wrong sense of life. It's all about. You haven't seen. How can Gene not have seen "It's a Wonderful Life"? You should all go see "It's a Wonderful Life" because it's a classic. But it doesn't get up there. Okay, "Miracle on 34th Street." Okay, Maureen O'Hara, Natalie Wood. How can you go wrong? It's cute. It's nice. I'm okay with it. Not my top movie, but okay. All right. "Holiday Inn," that's number three. That's a good movie, and it's with Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire. Love those movies. I encourage you to go see them. These are classics. This is not, you know, your modern stuff. All right, now come my Yaron Brooks number one Christmas movie of all time. Drum roll. Yeah, right, you've never heard of these movies because you guys, if it's not like from the 80s and beyond, you don't go back further. But the best movies ever made were made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Best movies ever made were made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And here's an example. One of the greatest movies ever made, 1940. My favorite Christmas movie of all time is Shop Around the Corner. You probably never heard of it, but it is a great movie. I've recommended it here on this show in the past. It's directed by Ernst Lubitsch, the greatest director of comedy ever. And it's with Margaret Sullivan and James Stewart. And you should all go rent it or watch it on Netflix tonight or tomorrow. It is fabulous. It's just so fun. It's so benevolent. It's great. It's just a good, good movie, right? All right. You've got mail. Somebody put up "You've Got Mail." "You've Got Mail" is a modern, pathetic remake. It's a remake of "Shop Around the Corner." You got to see the original. "You've Got Mail" is cute. "Shop Around the Corner" is brilliant. It's beautiful. It's acted finely, and your heart goes out to them. It's just the best Christmas movie, best romantic comedy ever. Okay, what else? Here's one I did not expect to see on the list, but I like this because it's a great movie. And again, you've never heard of it? Typical. Right? It's called Stalag 17. Right? It's about a German POW camp. And it really is a great movie. It's it's directed by Billy Wilder, one of the great directors, with William Holden, Peter Graves, Robert Strauss, you know, really great actors of the period, 1953. I'm telling you, best movies ever made, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Here you got Shop Around the Corner, Stalag 17, both excellent movies. Stalag 17, really dramatic, really exciting, directed by Billy Wilder, one of the great directors of all time. All right, that's the top five. Let's keep going. How do I get to number six? Okay, number six they've got as Tangerine. Never heard of it. Number seven, The Apartment, one of the greatest comedies of all time. I'm not sure why it's a Christmas movie, but again, Billy Wilder. Can't go wrong with Billy Wilder. 1960, Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, Fred McMurray. Wow. One of the great comedies of all the time. One of the great movies directed by Billy Wilder of all time. So The Apartment, you got, you know, an excellent movie, fun, entertainment, cute. Shirley MacLaine, give me a break, right? So, all right. Hey, Shop Around the Corner is on today, Saturday, December 24th at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Time on TCM. So, you know, record it. This is a great, great movie. All right. The Apartment. The Nightmare Before Christmas. This is the one with Tim Burton. Cute. I liked it. Okay. Not bad. For a modern movie, pretty good. I'll go with that. All right. Ah, here it is. The classic. The one and only. One of the great action movies of all time, and certainly a Christmas movie. In many ratings, I've seen this as the number one Christmas movie of all time. Are you ready for it? Die Hard, the first one. Die Hard with Bruce Willis. Now, that was a fun action movie. I'll go with that. Bruce Willis, Alan Rickman, just the whole, you know, high, you know, L.A. skyscraper being blown up. So Nightmare Before Christmas, Die Hard. Die Hard's not bad. I'll buy that. This one's Arthur Christmas, number 10. Never heard of Arthur Christmas. Don't know. A Christmas Story. A Christmas Story. Don't know. 1983. I'm suspicious. The Miracle on Morgan's Creek, 1944. See, this is a movie I've never heard of. It's 1944. I'm going to go watch this because it's 1944. In 1944, they made good movies. All right. Let's see. What else? Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale, 2010. This is number 13, best Christmas movie ever. Never heard of it. Okay, In Bruges. This is a 2008 movie that I've seen. Come on. It's not a Christmas movie. That's ridiculous. It's not a bad movie. It's a pretty good movie. But it ain't no Christmas movie. I don't get it. It's very well made. It's very suspenseful. You want a thriller? A fun thriller to watch, In Bruges, but I wouldn't watch it on Christmas. Wouldn't watch it on Christmas. Okay, number 15 is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Now, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a fun movie, action movie. Again, not a Christmas movie. Robert Downey Jr. is excellent, and Val Kilmer is excellent. It's fun. Go watch it. Not Christmas. I don't buy it Christmas, so I'm critiquing their list. All right, let's see number 16. What do we have as number 16? A Christmas Tale. No. Tokyo Godfather, 17. Never heard of it. Gremlins from 1994. I don't know. Trading Places. I love Trading Places. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Excellent movie. If you've never seen Trading Places, it's stupid because of the way they treat finance and speculation. It doesn't get it. It's dumb in that regard. So, you know, you have to suffer through that. But you know, you gotta watch Trading Places, one of the great comedies of all time. Excellent, directed by John Landis, who made some great comedies. And Trading Places, okay. And Midnight Clear, never heard of it. Elf, I didn't like Elf. All right, A Christmas Carol. Now, it's a good movie. It's just so wrong, right? Like, the hero of A Christmas Carol should be Scrooge. I should have done the whole show on Scrooge, on the heroism of Scrooge. Why Scrooge is a good guy, right? He's paying market wages. I mean, what do you call the guy who works for him, who always think he deserves more. I can't remember, right? Cratchit. So if Cratchit deserves more, why does he go get another job, right? Obviously, he's getting market wages. What's he complaining about? Scrooge is actually building up the economy. Anyway, you know me. I'm pro-Scrooge, but A Christmas Carol, a classic. There are multiple versions of this. Fun to watch, I guess. Okay, here's another action movie that's very Christmassy. One of my favorite action movies with a lot of sense of humor and a lot of fun aspect to it. And it is called Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon, 1987. 1987. The '80s we had pretty good action movies. So Die Hard and Lethal Weapon, two action movies. And then number 24 is A Bishop's Wife. It's okay. It's Cary Grant, David Niven, Loretta Young. Great performances. Good movie, qua movie. You know, philosophically, I can't remember all the details, but you know, it's a typical Christian movie with lots of cutie angels and a lot of altruism. And finally, number 25 is the best Batman movie ever, Batman Returns. Dark, brooding. Wait a minute. This is not the one I meant. Well, anyway, this is what they list. I don't know if I'd list it. Batman Returns, Tim Burton's Batman Returns, Michael Keaton. I don't know. I like the other Batman, the ones that were made by, I forget his name. Anyway, the more modern ones. All right, 25 best Christmas movies. Now we've got Scrooge by Bill Murray. They didn't have that. That's a good movie. Elf. I don't really like Elf. I think it's kind of silly. I need to watch A Christmas Story. Everybody's been recommending this for a long time. What else? Aunt Mame. I never heard of it. What else are people recommending here? Let's see. All right. Shop Around the Corner. I recommend it. All right. I don't see any others. There's a bunch of other ones. Holiday Inn has some wonderful music by Irving Berlin. So you got some stuff to go watch. And look, enjoy this holiday. This is the coolest holiday. It's a holiday to celebrate life. This is the objectivist holiday. Forget about Jesus. Who cares? Forget about, you know, the Jews winning against the... This is why you got it. You got to focus. Focus. Lights, presents, cool stuff, people you love, people producing and creating stuff, exchanging gifts with people that you care for, that you value. That is what Christmas is about. And for those of you who have a white Christmas, then it's also beautiful on top of everything else. All right. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Tweet it, share it. Hopefully Facebook won't make the Facebook Live thing disappear like it did last time. So please share the Facebook Live of it. Share the blog talk. We got to get viewership up, listenership up, back to November levels when we went through the roof. Hey, Merry Christmas, everybody. And next show is going to be New Year's. And for New Year's, I'm going to do 2016 in review. What did I think of 2016? Lots to talk about. And then the show after that is going to be assessing Obama's presidency. So the next two shows are 2016 in review and assessing Obama's presidency. And have fun watching all those great Christmas movies with people you love while exchanging gifts. It doesn't get much better than this. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.